from KQED.
From the Exploratorium in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. With greater concern for environmental issues and the growing of California's green economy, we discuss in this hour what is being done in schools and in educational public policy about teaching students about the environment and about environmental science. What are the best means of bringing greater ecological awareness and appreciation of nature in a school curriculum? We'll be joined by a panel, including environmental activist and author Bill McKibben, and we'll take your calls next, after this. From the Exploratorium in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, and we have an enthusiastic audience with us. And welcome to the second hour of our special science education program with greater concern for environmental issues and the growing of California's green economy. In this hour, we want to discuss what is being done in schools and in education public policy about teaching students about the environment and environmental science. What are the best means of bringing greater ecological awareness and appreciation of nature to school curricula? We're talking about that, and I should say by way of introduction that back in October of 2003, a bill was passed by the California Assembly, AB 1548, designed to bring education about the environment into the California schools. Recently, the state's Board of Education approved a curriculum, the first of its kind in the nation, which has been tested in 19 districts and which will be instituted this fall. It includes 85 units of environment-related education, but it will not be required for teachers. So what then about the importance of environmental education as part of the teaching of science in California? Again, that's the focus for this hour, and with us is Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org organization, an international climate campaign, which he talked with us about. How do you pronounce Earth with two A's, by the way, Bill?
You should be able to do it. In this state, you kind of have to channel your inner Schwarzenegger. It's sort of Earth.
That's the title. Easy to remember. Earth. Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Bill will be appearing tonight at 7 p.m. at Dominican University in San Rafael, and he's been fighting to stop climate change since he published The End of Nature back in 1989, a long battle and a very admirable one, to put it mildly. Also with us, Sum Zargar, who is an AP environmental science teacher at Terra Linda High School, and he's been there 7 years teaching biology and environmental sciences. Welcome to the program, Sum.
Thank you.
We also have with us Amarina Treff, who is a field science educator at Nature Bridges Headlands Institute campus. Nature Bridges is the largest environmental education partner of the National Park Service, providing residential field science programs to over 30,000 students annually. She teaches science programs outdoors. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mr. Krasny.
And glad to have you all. It's Michael. Glad to have you all here. Let me begin with Bill McKibben, and I'm looking at part of the press materials of his book about the Earth. Climate change statistics, boy, you look at these, it's grim. And to teach students to have hope, which I know you want to do, to make them feel that they have a real concern, and not only a concern, but an investment in this cause of doing something about global warming, how do you get past all those statistics?
Well, the first thing you do is not try to get past them. The first thing you do is deal with the reality of the situation. And in fact, I work almost exclusively, all my colleagues around the world in this huge 350.org thing are mostly young people. And I find that they're completely able to deal with reality. In some ways, they deal with it more easily than older people do. We've screwed up. You know, I started issuing, you know, The End of Nature was the first book about climate change. We issued strong warnings from lots of quarters. We didn't pay attention to them. Now we're paying the price. So the ocean is 30% more acid. The Arctic is melting. The atmosphere holds 5% more water vapor. And as a result, we get these huge storms. This is the new reality, the new Earth, and it's a different planet. But it will get a lot worse if we don't do things about it. And that process of doing things about it is what young people around the world are now catalyzing. They're really the ones who are pushing leaders everywhere to start taking serious action to move us from fossil fuel to renewable energy, which is the task of the 21st century.
Take the fossil out of fossil fuel. Huh?
That's it.
You are pretty much advocating hope depending on scaling back. So teaching involves making students more aware of the need to scale back?
Well, it involves... One of the things it involves is understanding that the sort of set of habits we have in this world aren't the only possible way to live. For 50 or 60 years, our political system in a bipartisan fashion has adopted further growth as the only answer to every question that comes up. It's how we avoid tough choices. Great plan, except that we're now running into those limits to growth that 40 years ago on the first Earth Day, people really began talking about. And you know, when you melt the Arctic, that's not a good sign, okay? So we need to start understanding that we're going to need some new habits. We're going to have to start talking at least as much about resilience and stability as we do about growth. And in our classrooms, you know, these are biological phenomena just the same way growth is. Maturation, stability, these are important concepts that we need to get through.
Here's a scenario. A student goes and learns about global warming, comes home and says to parents, I'm learning about the fact that the planet may be destroyed because of our carelessness. It's a new planet. It's a planet we have to preserve. And the father says, I heard Rush Limbaugh say global warming doesn't exist. And your teachers are teaching you subversive things and they're radicalizing you. And goes to the principal and goes to the superintendent. I'm talking about a real scenario.
Absolutely. So, look, dealing with, in this country, and it's the only place where you really have to deal with it around the world, this phenomenon of sort of climate denialism is a problem. It's a problem because we're deeper in denial, because we're more addicted, and because the power of the fossil fuel industry is large. On the other hand, it's increasingly possible to say to people who think of themselves, say, as Rush Limbaugh conservatives, there's not the slightest thing conservative on earth about doubling the carbon content of the atmosphere and seeing what happens. Abby Hoffman, on his most radical day, never thought of any plan as radical as that. There's nothing conservative about letting the Chinese get the complete ownership of the green energy industry, which is what's happening right now. Even the Pentagon has now identified the kind of chaos spreading from a destabilizing planet as the biggest threat that we're facing in the century ahead. So, you're not going to convince everybody. If you've spent your life marinating in Rush Limbaugh, the odds that you're really going to, you know, catch up on this is small. But what we do need to take is the people who care about this, and it is the majority of the American public and the vast majority of the world's public, and get them mobilized. Last October, this 350.org campaign that I've been helping run, we managed on a single day in October to mobilize 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. It was the most widespread day, CNN said, of political action in the planet's history on any issue. We can build that movement. We can counter that power of the fossil fuel industry, and we can do it in very hopeful ways, energizing young people around the world to take some... the problem with dealing with climate change is it's so big. So anybody plugging in their new light bulb feels on the one hand a little virtuous and on the other hand understands that they're not solving global warming that way. So you have to also give people things to do that have enough leverage to really make a difference. On the first Earth Day, 40 years ago, we built a political movement that still is sort of running off that momentum. If you don't believe me, look at the average age of the members of our environmental organizations. We need some new momentum now, and that comes with education and with organizing, and they go hand in hand.
I'm still trying to get my mind off of the image of marinated in Rush Limbaugh. Can you at least give some of the listeners who don't know about 350.org why that number?
Absolutely.
And what it's about?
So 350 is, in some ways, it's a huge science education project. 350 is the most important number in the world. We didn't even know it was important until January of 2008, when our most important climatologists, led by Jim Hansen at NASA, put out a series of papers saying, we finally know enough about the planet to understand what the red line is. Any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million, they said, was not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed or to which life on Earth is adapted. That is strong language for scientists to use, and it's stronger still when you realize we're already well past it. I mean, outside today, the atmosphere holds 390 parts per million CO2. That's why the Arctic is melting. That's why the oceans are acidifying, and it's why we have to go to work in a serious way. We've damaged this planet already. It is a new Earth in some sense, but it'll get a lot worse than that if we don't start taking real action.
Bill McKibben here with us at the Exploratorium, founder of 350.org, and also the author of Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. By the way, they use that at Redwood High School in the AP class. It's part of the curriculum. Bill's book is in the science class. And Sam Zargar teaches there. And the thing you learn about getting kids to interact with the environment, to appreciate this planet, is once you get them outside, they really take to it generally, don't they?
Absolutely. I think every student would tell you that if there was an opportunity to go outside to do something outside of the classroom, they're all for it. So I think one of the things that we've been able to do in the time that I've been teaching the course in environmental science is provide the opportunities for students, and simply in partnership with a lot of community organizations, both nonprofit and just science organizations in the community. And we're so lucky that in Northern California we have just a tremendous amount of resources that are willing to work with our students in the fields of environmental science. So in the 4 years that I've been teaching this course, there has been tremendous opportunity to go outside of the curriculum, outside of the classroom, and for the students to be involved in a lot of real life, today, current issues that are going on, the things they're reading about in their textbooks, the videos they're seeing, and really partake in activities that allow them to kind of have a complete understanding of the curriculum.
But you know, there's an old Woody Allen line where he said, I am too with nature, and I'm wondering if you have students who really don't necessarily feel an affinity to nature, can it inspire them more to feel that sense of affinity?
I think so. I think, you know, we're going to get a wide variety of students taking the course for a variety of reasons. And I think our job in the classroom is to simply, you know, take the number of students that we get and really talk about, and it really comes down to understanding and appreciating the complexities of their environment.
Do they make that connection, though, to say the kinds of things that Bill McKibben's talking about and out there in the world of nature?
They start to. And I think they start to once they understand how it applies to their own lives. I think if on a daily basis we're able to make the connection between the things we're teaching, the things we're talking about, to their daily lives, and the fact that most of these environmental issues or things we're talking about are going to be in certainly within their lifetime, with the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So once they understand that, they start to have a discussion, understanding, you know what, this stuff really is making sense to me. I should think about this stuff a little bit more.
Do you try to communicate the sense of being a citizen and actually trying to make a difference, being political minded, whether you're whatever political persuasion you might be?
In to a sense, yes. I teach about 70 kids a year in environmental science, and they're all from different walks of life. So for them to kind of see how it applies to their life and how it applies to their interest is the challenge. But it's the beauty of it all. I think that's what we try to do.
And we have a young lady by the name of Angela Wu on the phone with us, and I want to introduce her because she's a senior at Skyline High School in Oakland Unified School District, currently taking an environmental science class. And Angela, good to have you here. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. And tell us about the science class you're taking now.
Right now I'm taking environmental science, which is taught by Ms. Ostrom. We are currently covering energy, so we just finished a unit on renewable energy, solar, wind, water, and before we did the one on non-renewable energy, and right now we're about to get ready for the AP exam.
And you're excited about this, huh?
Not the AP exam.
Oh, no, I didn't mean the AP exam. Go to the previous antecedent. I mean, you're excited about the course you're taking.
Yes, definitely.
You're going to Rice University next year?
Mm-hmm.
And the first one in your family to go to college, congratulations.
Thank you.
I know your mother's very proud.
Definitely.
Tell us what drew you to science and what draws you to environmental science.
for in the Oakland Unified School Districts, a lot of the departments aren't really strong, but science was always one of the stronger ones. So for that, I was always attracted to the science classes available and offered to me. And a lot of the teachers in there were really amazing. And while I was choosing my courses for this year, I was deciding between physiology or environmental science. And I realized that environmental science is becoming increasingly important in our in the 21st century. And I also really liked Ms. Ostrom because I had her for chemistry as well. And she just has this incredible passion for it, and it just, it attracts me to it.
That makes a difference, doesn't it? Tremendous, dramatic difference. Tell us about some of the field trips you've gone on.
We went on a field trip for nursery propagation, and we learned about the invasive species and native species. And I never really knew that the grass that we have where my school is, there were some invasive species, and that was why some of them were yellow at a certain time of the year. And I just found that really fascinating. And we also helped out by clearing away some of those invasive species and helping to replant those native species. And another one that I was supposed to go on was a canoe trip, but unfortunately that got canceled. But we still were able to go to the wetlands, and we were able to like help by cleaning up the coastal areas and planting some native grasses as well.
Well, good luck to you, Angela. I'm glad you joined us here this morning, and continue your interest in science, and I hope it continues to be cultivated.
Thank you.
Angela Wu, she's a senior at Skyline High School in Oakland Unified School District. Amarina Treff is here with us in the Exploratorium this morning also. She's a field science educator at Nature Bridges Headlands Institute campus. Nature Bridges, again, the largest environmental education partner of the National Park Service, providing residential field science programs to over 30,000 students each year. And they like it, huh? A lot of them? Most of them? All of them?
They love it. And kind of like Caleb in the last hour said, he probably has the best job in the world. I might try to say that I have a better job. I love my job. And the kids, they love it when they come out there. There's nothing that beats seeing the ocean for the first time, even if you're from San Francisco. And a lot of Nature Bridges students, that's their reality. That's their experience. And it's just to see that, wow, is...
Where do you go from
irreplaceable.
that irreplaceable, because it's awe, really, that you're talking about, mm-hmm. excitement and so forth, to making the connection to the
yeah.
kinds of things Bill McKibben was talking about?
I think that wow happens for some kids. It doesn't happen for all kids right away. It can also be a really uncomfortable experience to be outside. At Nature Bridge, we're teaching kids outdoors, and we're having them there for anywhere from 1 day to 5 days during a residential program. So kids are coming out of their normal... neighborhood, their community. And so being outdoors could be also uncomfortable. So the first thing we do is try to instill a connection, try to make it a fun experience. And that part of the job's easy because we do have the ocean views and, you know, amazing cliffs that we're looking out towards the ocean from. But to really get to, I think, what Bill's talking about, the environmental issues and what AP environmental science classes are teaching, to get to that, you have to first have the kids have that connection. And you have to instill that and make it fun, make it safe, make it comfortable for them to be outdoors, to love it. Then you can start to teach them, and I think every student has the right to deserve, that they deserve, and they have the right to know about environmental issues first, for their own safety, for their community's safety, for the future.
First, before they go out and experience nature? Or?
Before, I think that's maybe not first, but that we all have that right.
You mean as a priority? Then.
As a priority, that's yeah. what I mean. Thank you. And from there, once they have that connection, it's easier for them, I think, to start feeling more invested about those issues, about those environmental issues. When they see that ocean wave, they can then say, wow, there's a huge garbage patch out there? What? You know, and start to learn about that. Wow, plastic water bottles can affect our health sometimes? Whoa, how does that affect me? How does that affect my family? Now, what choices do I want to make so that I can be safe? What are those choices? And so our job and our charge is really to provide them with the tools to make smart choices.
There's a sense in California of the importance of environmental education. As I said, there's this 85 hours now in the curriculum, and there are standards, but they're not tested. There's no review process. This presents a thorn, doesn't it?
Yes, it definitely does. I think with so many tests being kind of crammed down the throats of the students, and having the priority be on the language arts and the math, and having teachers be in a time crunch, it's really difficult to provide that. And that was talked about in the first hour of the program.
But you feel it, too, in the work you do.
In the work we do, we're fortunate because schools have already made that commitment. Parents, students have already made the commitment to come out to a NatureBridge campus. So
but
to come out to the Headlands Institute. Coming out there, they've already done that. So we have them for that period of time. What happens before and after, though, that's where we want to really
Well, I was thinking about that before. You've got kids who come from underserved communities. They take them out to Marin Headlands, and it's like walking onto another planet, you know. Or
yes.
It's like seeing James Cameron's movie in 3D or something,
right.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Right, it is. Yeah. And I think then the issue is how do we get those students out there? How does NatureBridge get them out there? How do the schools get them out there? Where are the priorities there? And it's pretty tough. I talked with one teacher from an Oakland school from a very low-income community, and what we offer scholarships. We offer about a 50% scholarship based on need, based on free and reduced lunch programs, and the number of students who are qualifying for that. So when we offer those scholarships, we still want the schools to have an investment, the students and the families to have an investment. So we do ask them to come up with some of the money, and that's serious work for those schools. Parents do tons of fundraisers with their students, and then also the schools ask the parents to contribute some money, and even $50 can be very difficult for a family living on a minimum wage income with multiple students.
I want to go back to you, Bill McKibben, particularly again about making this connection.
A story just popped into my mind that sort of underlines how important the work that these guys are doing is. I remember years and years ago taking out a bunch of high school kids for their first camping trip, okay? And we were out. It was the new moon, so the
it's
night
in Vermont.
It was in the Adirondacks in upstate New York, where I lived most of my life. And new moon, dark night, stars everywhere. We're out. Of the six or seven high school seniors that I was with, four of them, no one had ever shown them the Milky Way before, okay? So their reaction was appropriate. I mean, I remember somebody looking up and saying, "Whoa, freak me out, dude," you know? And that's, you know, pretty much the moment at which we became human was when some ape looked up for me and said, "Whoa, freak me out, dude." I mean, you know, this sort of, I think what
They spoke that way in Paleolithic times?
Absolutely, man. And but the main experience, and the one that goes so against our culture in a way, is being out someplace, realizing that there are things larger than you. Because every force in our consumer culture is devoted to the proposition that you're the most important thing on earth. You as an individual are the, you know, sort of heaviest object in the known universe about what all else must orbit. And all of a sudden you get out there and you see the ocean, you see the way, you have some sense of the vastness of things. Well, that's a very subversive, as it turns out, in our culture idea. And it's in many ways the beginning, far before you have to tell everybody about environmental problems and things, simply allowing them to fall in love with and have some sense of their place in the scale of things is the ground that we've too often lost.
Well, I'm going to give those of you in the audience an opportunity to be a part of this conversation. In fact, I'd encourage you, and you are cordially invited to do that. If you have something you'd like to contribute, question, or comment, raise your hand. We will find you and come to you. And our listeners, you can join us. Toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, we'd like to hear from you as well. We'll go to our audience. We'll go to our listeners. After we go to a quick break, again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786. As we continue San Francisco's world-famous Exploratorium, I'm Michael Krasny. Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. We are live at the Exploratorium with this hearty, robust audience of ours. And I ought to add that in the audience we have some environmental science students, and I would encourage those of you who fall into that category to please join us in conversation, which you can do. We'll go to our audience. We'll also go to our callers forthwith. I want to remind you who is with us. We have Amarina Treff with us, a field science educator at NatureBridge's Headlands Institute campus. Sam Zargar, who is an AP environmental science teacher at Terra Linda High School. I said Redwood High School was where Bill McKibben's book is being used, but they are not to be confused with one another. And Bill McKibben's with us as well, who will be at Dominican University in San Rafael tonight at 7 o'clock, founder of 350.org, and also the author of Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Tough word to pronounce, the way he puts those extra A's in there. I wanted to, before we go to our audience and before we go to our callers, talk a little bit more with Sam Zargar about the fact that, as Bill McKibben said, and you've experienced this, and I imagine, Amarina, you want to talk about this as well. Again, seeing that sense of wonder and seeing that excitement that Bill so nicely crystallized in the Adirondack story.
Absolutely. I think that, there's no doubt that a lot of these students are hungry, are interested for this material. And I think, and if we do a good job as teachers, as educators in the classroom and outside of classroom to get these kids excited, and if there's an opportunity to go visit places, they're ready to jump on board. They're ready to take it. They're ready to read about it, discuss it, talk about it with their families and their friends. So I think it is challenging. It is a newer topic for a lot of these students. It is still an elective course in a lot of schools. We're still very biology, chemistry, and physics. But once they get there, and if we do a good job delivering the content, they're ready to fly with you, and I think that's fascinating.
It's an AP course. Is it open enrollment, though?
It is. Okay. It is. And it's also been found at the ninth grade curriculum as simply as an environmental science curriculum, which is a nicer, I shouldn't say nicer, but it's another way of saying physical science. I think in the past we've had physical science.
And do you have to keep up with the research? I mean, things are happening all the time, as Mr. McKibben can certainly attest to. Classroom teacher have to be really up on top of things?
Absolutely. I think with this subject, more than any other subject, I think.
Climate change.
Daily readings, daily videos. And we try to bring a lot of that stuff into the classroom. But you have to be kind of on top of things so that you make the curriculum very current, very relevant, as I spoke earlier, to the students, because they're going to read about it somewhere else. Let's talk about it in the classroom, as a class.
And Marina Treff, let's talk again about what Bill McKibben again was describing so poetically, and that is, again, that sense of wonder, awe.
Sense of awe.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, there's so many stories that incorporate that same and really, crystallize that same sense that people have when they go outside and they realize, oh, it's not just me. It's not just about me and my phone, you know. And another is getting kids quiet, sitting them down towards sunset, and getting them quiet, overlooking a bluff at the headlands, Marin Headlands. And all of a sudden they hear frogs. And it might be the first time in their life they've heard frogs. It might not be, and it's still this special, really special
moment.
And
then you could say to them, you know what's happening to the frog population?
Yeah, right. No, not in that moment. You don't want to ruin it for them. But, that's that first thing, and it's just, it's irreplaceable, you know. It doesn't mean that's all we do. We also teach science. We teach a lot of inquiry as well. Those moments, though, you can't get those inside four walls usually, you know.
Well said. And we're going to go to the audience now and just let us know your name and what you have to say.
Hi, I'm Matthew Abram, senior at Terra Linda, currently enrolled in AP Environmental Science. About a week ago, we watched Bill Gates' speech at the TED conference concerning CO2 emissions, and he had an equation where it's population times affluence times energy and the emissions from the energy. And he said energy is currently going down, but the emissions is really what we need to get to zero to reach the goal of 20% emissions by 2050. Do you think that, Mr. McKibben said, everyone realizing there's a larger thing than themselves, that the affluence might also be able to go down to help reach that goal?
It's the right question.
It's Bill McKibben.
The consumption curve, I mean, look, we've sort of managed to begin to break the rising curve of population. Human fertility has dropped as women educated and empowered are beginning to have markedly fewer children. Now it's that ever-rising consumption curve that we're going to have to figure out somehow how to deal with. One of the ways to do it, one of the political things we need to do, is put a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the environment. If we were paying for gas and oil and electricity what the cost they were exacting around us, we'd be using less of them. And that's one of the places that we very much need to go in order to do just what you described.
So if a classroom teacher says cap and trade and starts going along that line, again, might go home and the father or mother might say, It's like teaching creationism, or it's like teaching intelligent design or something from some other perspective.
Well, you know, I don't think probably in most places classroom teachers are, you know, outlining precisely what bills the Senate should be passing and, you know, all this. But I do think that one of the things that's challenging for teachers about all of this sort of stuff is that environmental studies and science uniquely has to take into account economics, psychology, sociology, a whole vast range of things. It's, if economics was the organizing principle for the last century, and it really was, it's what we all focused on, economic growth, in a certain sense, environmental studies is the organizing principle for this one, and it's a vastly more difficult thing to think about because there are more moving parts.
We'll go to one of our callers, Sandy from San Jose, joining us. Good morning. Sandy, are you there?
Back there. I don't have a radio on.
I don't have a radio on. Well,
oh,
that's...
I hear that.
That's, thank you, Sandy. We've got you now, I think.
Thank you. I'm down in a conference room, so I could barely hear your ghost voice in the background. So great. I've been listening for the past half hour upstairs, and I just had to come down and share what some students in San Jose are doing. Children's Discovery Museum of San Jose has a biosite program, students investigating their environment. And there are high school students at Pioneer High School, Leland High School, among others, that spend time learning the content, the mentoring skills, and the leadership skills so that they become the teachers to the elementary kids who come out to the Guadalupe River watershed and study their creeks. It's just a great combination of what many of you have mentioned, that what's important now in getting students to connect to place, to be wowed, to learn the content, and accept the responsibility. It's all that. It's been great.
And it's good of you to let us know about it. Thank you, Sandy.
You're welcome.
And we're going to go to the audience next.
Hi, my name is Christian Manoli, and I'm also a senior at Terra Linda High School. And I mean, obviously, in today's job market, college students are kind of limited with what they can do after college. And I was wondering if an environmental science type of, like, what type of jobs are out there for kids who, like, specialize in environmental science type of thing.
So. All right. We've got vocational advisor Bill McKibben here with us.
You know, it's funny. I teach at a little bit at Middlebury College in Vermont, where the environmental studies department's now one of the biggest departments. It's the oldest one in the country there. And 20 years ago, it wasn't at all clear what kind of career you were going to get coming out of there. Now it's, you know, one of the few places where you can almost name where you want to go work. We need immense numbers of people who know about everything from carbon accounting to new technology engineering to environmental economics is the fastest growing part of that field. This is, if you look around the world and try to figure out where we might be really putting people to work in the next 20 or 30 or 40 years, i.e. over your career lifetime, it's very clear that this transition from renewable energy, from fossil energy to renewable energy, is going to be the biggest thing that's going on. So figure out some piece of it and then make sure that this country plays some role, that the entire action isn't going to happen in China, where they're making much larger investments right now than we are.
Yeah, if the greening of the economy occurs, you may find yourself a job in it. Let's hope so. And we'll go back to the audience. Thank you for that.
Hi, my name is Eduardo, and I'm hoping that the panel can comment on age-appropriate approaches to studying environmental issues such as climate change. Thanks.
I think that's something that...
this is Amarina Treff.
That's something we deal with a lot at NatureBridge campuses and looking at. If we have a group of first graders, I'm not going to teach them about climate change. Right. That's not the way it's going to start. I'm going to get them outside, enjoying the climate that's there, enjoying the world, and starting teaching them basic concepts about biology, about ecology, about earth and physical sciences, so they have an understanding. They're starting with a base, a wide base of knowledge. From there, as they grow up and have those experiences, hopefully they then come to a place where they feel a connection, and so then when they're at an appropriate age where it's not going to totally turn them off and make them feel like, oh, you know, we're at 390 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We're screwed. Oh, well. You know, because they're like, they've heard that since they were little and they're desensitized to it. Instead of that, maybe, you know, introducing that as in fifth, sixth, seventh, and so on grades.
Let me bring Jeff in, another one of our callers. Jeff, join us. Hi, you're on forum.
My name's Jeff. I live in Sebastopol, and I was thinking, I just heard the word age-appropriate. Well, I think it's age-appropriate for every student to go to a landfill and discover what's going on with their garbage when it leaves their house in the recycle and in the garbage itself, where it goes, the creatures that feed off it from the seagulls, et cetera, et cetera. And it's an eye-opening experience, and I think they need to do that. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Have either of you done some?
We have not gone to a landfill. Certainly there's one near us, but we can do so. But one other comment on the age appropriateness of environmental science. I think as in the first hour of the show was alluded to, one of the great things about environmental science is that it can be embedded in so many different curriculum, from the science, from the math, from the English. And there are a number of universities out there. I can think of, I think UC Merced, and I think SUNY Southampton campus, State University of New York, that has environmental science embedded in their curriculum, from their English courses to their math courses to their social studies courses to their political science courses. So I think we're seeing a lot of that. I think that's fascinating for these kids to take these courses at the collegiate level and be involved or learn about environmental science while learning about their education.
Yeah, good point. Bill McKibben.
Look, this, what people are saying is just right, and Anne Marina made just the right point. You don't want six-year-olds freaking out about the environment. People don't fall in love with terminally ill people for the most part.
And they don't have the power at that age.
That's right. But as soon as they do find out, and in our world, they're going to find out at a certain point, not too far down the road, you got to give them things to do that allow them to feel some sense of power or mastery in this thing. So when we did this like big day of organizing last fall, there's 25,000 pictures in our Flickr account from those 5,000 demonstrations around the world, rallies, all kind of. It was amazing to see how many young people were kind of leading the charge and connecting with each other. And the one thing that they have going for them is because they grew up on Facebook, this visceral sense of the connection of people around the world, the easy communion between people that may allow them to become quite powerful political actors, you know, to feel much more empowered than the more isolated generation that came before.
Bill, you were saying to me before that Donahue kind of dates you, and I may be dating myself here, but there's a book called Barefoot Boy with Cheek by Max Schulman, Rally Around the Flag Boys by Max Schulman, which is about teaching sex education to six-year-olds, as you mentioned, six-year-olds, obviously age inappropriate. When do you decide, or about what age do you decide that it is appropriate, particularly to learn, again, I'm going back to some of these grim statistics, the safe level of carbon dioxide, 350 parts per million, we're already at 390, the kinds of things that give you real pause and make you concerned.
I think that you sort of first have, I think it depends a lot on what community you're in a way, and what chance people have had to fall in love first with the world around them. I remember, you remember the great writer Ed Abbey, the great desert writer and one of our real heroes. I remember Abbey telling me once, we were hiking someplace in the Utah desert. He was saying, you know, if I can get any kid out here before the age of 16 for a week, I can turn him into a lifelong lover of the natural world. I can change their life. After 16, the silence begins to scare them. You know, it's hard to, I don't know what the exact age for that is, but I know that that process of falling in love with the natural world should happen as early as it can, and that one of the most important things people can do with young kids is get them out places where they can, and sometimes these are just city parks or gardens, any place where you can experience yourself as part of some larger process.
It's also exposure. Yesterday we had Neil deGrasse Tyson on the air with us of NOVA, the astrophysicist who heads up the Hayden Planetarium, and he said he was 12 years old, and he looked up in a planetarium and looked at the sky, and that was it. You know, now he's one of the certainly better known astrophysicists in this country. Not a retired one like our guest the first hour who said she was, you know, in a recovery group. Yeah. Let's go back to our audience. Yes.
Hi, my name is Lily Weigert. I'm from Sausalito, and I have a question for Mr. McKibben about the Copenhagen Conference. there was so much excitement leading up to that, and then afterward, all we really heard from the mainstream media was that it was a colossal failure. I'm wondering if you thought we achieved anything or what we could have done differently.
So here was the place where it was, for me, really good to have a lot of young people around. We brought at 350.org the largest delegation to this thing, 350 young people from all over the world, people who'd been our key organizers on every continent. When we got to the end of the conference, we'd convinced 117 nations to sign on to this quite ambitious 350 target, but they were the wrong 117 nations. They were the poor countries of the world, not the most deeply addicted ones led by our own. So I was feeling discouraged when it fizzled, and they all looked up at me and said, well, what did you expect? We've only been really organizing for a year around the world. We're up against the most profitable enterprise that human beings ever figured out, you know, refining fossil fuels. Of course we're not going to win right away. We need to come back and organize bigger and stronger. This October 10th, 10-10-10, we're having this huge global work party, and it's going to be really cool for lots of people, young and old, to feel very empowered in that way. And it's going to send a strong message to our leaders if we can get to work putting up solar panels. I mean, if I can, if your students can climb up on the roof of the school and hammer in solar panels, then surely our senators could be bothered to climb up on the floor of the Senate and hammer out some legislation, you know? Time to get to work. And that kind of imperative, cutting through a lot of the nonsense, is something that young people really bring to this. They understand intuitively that the debate about climate is not between, shouldn't be between liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats. It's a debate between human beings on the one hand and physics and chemistry on the other. Okay, and that's a very tough negotiation to win. Physics and chemistry really aren't that interested in changing their minds, you know. They've pretty much established their position. You want a planet that works the way you like it working? 350 parts per million. Take it or leave it. Well, we've got to figure out how to do that. It's possible to do it. And young people in particular are flexible enough to begin to figure out what that next world looks like.
And again, Milton McKibben's new book is, I'm just going to say Earth with two A's. Earth making a life on a tough new planet. Let me go to more of your calls. Catherine joining us from Sacramento. Good morning.
Am I on?
You're on with a big buzz, but go ahead.
Yes, okay. I don't know why, but I'm with the United Nations Association in Northern California, and I wanted to ask if we can get work on climate change into the California and United States schools as a requirement, not just as something in the more affluent and educated districts.
Okay, it's an important question, and thank you for the call. And let's talk about it again with you, Bill McKibben. I mean, you've been so much a vanguard in terms of this political activism. What about what she's suggesting here in California?
Well, I don't know exactly what the curriculum standards are in California. I know that around the world, and especially at higher education, everybody now is studying these questions because you can't study any of the relevant disciplines, economics or science, without stumbling across them. But what's most interesting to me is to watch the kind of parallel education that's also going on. For instance, one of the biggest demonstrations we had last October 24th came in one of the poorest capitals on Earth, Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And it was because two sisters, 18 and 19, who we'd trained at 350.org, had in turn gone out and convinced every high school in the city that they needed to be talking about studying global warming. And they did, sometimes informally and sometimes formally, but with a sense of excitement and enthusiasm, not because it was something that they had to be studying, it was because it was something that was very alive. And as a result, when October 24th rolled around, one of the biggest demonstrations that happened in the world, tens of thousands of people, was in the streets of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. Quite remarkable to see.
Again, we want to go to you in the audience, so if you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, if you have a question or comment, just raise your hand and we will indeed go to you. We'll go to this gentleman over here.
It's Modesto, and I work at the Exploratorium. I teach here, and actually I've been very fortunate to actually almost lose my life at the foot of a glacier up in Alaska and spin into the caldera of a volcano in Costa Rica and get over, almost run over by a guanaco in Patagonia. having all those places in front of me, my favorite place in the world is the Headlands in San Francisco. But what I like to do is, because a lot of people can't even get to that place, is to learn about the ecology of the city. And there's some wonderful things. In Chicago, I used to take my kids to the Silurian rocks that were found by the lakefront. There are crack patterns, so we're actually looking at the exploratorium. So find out about the ecology of the city, and everyone can be there, everyone lives there.
And these scary stories you tell don't need to make people want to stay away from nature. Thank you for that. Yes.
Can I say really quick to that? You're right on.
And Marina Treff.
When you say that, you know, finding nature in the city is what I'm hearing when you're saying that. And exploring and finding that sense of wonder within our city. And that I think it's important not to dichotomize and say, nature's on one end, and when I'm in the city, I'm not on Earth. I'm not in nature. And that's huge. So figuring out, and that's same for at Nature Bridge, same for when you're in the classroom, Sam, I'm sure, helping your students to understand how to take it back. How is this relevant to my home community? How is this relevant to me? And it may be a concept or an issue that seems big and separate, like climate change, because we're only starting to see the effects, or it may be something smaller, like how do I do inquiry on the sidewalk? And thank you so much for bringing that point up.
And can you mention some places that Nature Bridge, for example, would recommend to go to in the city in San Francisco?
Anywhere. Ask the kids. I mean, that's what we do at the end of our program. We ask the kids, okay, so you just spent 3 days or 5 days in a national park, but your journey, your experience doesn't end here. How can you take this back? Where are you going to continue to learn about this outdoors? And the kids just will list off. I mean, it's amazing. All the parks, their own backyard, and if they live in an apartment, the front of that. Or birding by Muni. That's an activity that's amazing. Identifying birds while you're riding the Muni. So, I mean, there's tons of ways you can do it. And a part of that is teaching the kids how to think critically, teaching them how to be inquirers.
And we've got a question in our audience from one of our first hour panelists, Sue Boudreau.
Hi. We start the school year off with an activity called How Are You Connected to Nature? And we come back to that frequently throughout the year. We actually do a lot with food. You know, how is that the biodiversity of the supermarket, the biodiversity of your dinner? We have the kids grow food for themselves, which is really hard, especially as we have to start in October. And I guess the big message that I've taken from reading Bill McKibben's books and from the study of biology is the idea of connectedness, that not only that you lift up one thread, I think John Muir said, and you lift up the whole universe. We're connected to nature in a very intimate way, even if we think that we're not. We're connected to each other, and we're doing a project called the Take Action Project, which is where kids take informed and effective action on an issue of their choice. And I have different kids doing different things, different actions, and different issues that they care about. And then they make connections between those issues, and they look for root causes, and they pick up root causes, and they see how that rattles down through the system. But they're also making connections with each other, with their community. They're involving their parents. And I think that Bill's idea of connection and community is absolutely central. And I think it fits in with ecology. And I think within this sense of destruction, there are the seeds of redemption.
Sue, thank you for that. I'm also, since you mentioned the word connection, drawn again to an idea that I emphasized. I sound like I'm on a hobby horse here, but in the last hour I was talking about interdisciplinarity in science education. And you can teach students, speaking with my teacher's hat here, you can teach students a lot about nature through teaching poetry. I mean, through teaching Wordsworth, through teaching Lawrence, through teaching Hopkins, Whitman, and so forth. There's an extraordinary amount of understanding and appreciating the sense of nature.
Last year, I edited for the Library of America this huge doorstop of an anthology of American environmental writing since Thoreau. And, you know, Earth Day in San Francisco is the right place to be thinking about a lot of this. Sue mentioned John Muir. The environmental movement was born in San Francisco with the birth of the Sierra Club. And I can't be here without thinking of people like David Brower, the great hero of late 20th century American environmentalism. And to make that point so powerfully about the city, you know, he lived his whole life. He spent a lot of time in Yosemite and did a lot of first ascents in the Sierras, but he lived his whole life in the Berkeley Hills and used to spend just as many happy hours up at Indian Rock, you know, clamoring around. That sense of exploration and of connection and poetry is something that we've got to recapture. It's very important to understand the biology and the chemistry and the physics. The numbers and the statistics are at the heart of much of the work that I do. But in the end, these questions are about choices that we want to make about the future, what kind of world we want to have. And right now, we're at a crux moment. Do we want a kind of living world that is it bears some relation to the very beautiful one that we were born onto? If we do, then we need to start acting, and acting with some real passion and some real speed.
You act with passion, therefore you remain hopeful. That's what I assume.
That's exactly right. There are moments when it's easy to despair because the world is not as sweet as the one we were born onto, and we're going to see a lot of more damage done in the years ahead. That ocean we look out to from the headlands is growing steadily more acid. That's not good. But there's no use mourning that which we can't prevent. There's much use celebrating that which is still intact and gorgeous. And there's even more use taking our lives and using them to try and preserve what we can of the world that we once knew.
Perfect note on which to end. I want to thank Bill McKibben, activist, author, founder of 350.org. which is an international climate change campaign, and again, his latest book, Earth with Two A's, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. He'll be at Dominican University tonight at 7. Thanks to Sam Zargar, AP environmental science teacher at Terra Linda High School in Marin, and thanks to Amarina Treff, field science educator at Nature Bridges Headlands Institute campus. Also, Angela Wu, who joined us earlier by phone, a senior at Skyline High School in Oakland's Unified School District. Also want to thank the people at the Exploratorium, Leslie Patterson, Linda Dackner, and Brian Hickey, who had a good deal to making this broadcast, this very special broadcast, possible. Thanks to our KQED Quest staff, Amy Standen and Jessica Neely, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Kevin Guillory, and Tina Larberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I thank you, our audience. I'm Michael Krasny.
Support for this hour of Forum is provided in part by the Walter S. Johnson Foundation. Additional funding for the production of Forum is provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.